For our message this evening, I simply gave this message a small title. It's simply entitled, No Excuses. No Excuses. You know, excuses sound good in our minds. Oftentimes they're not as good as they sound. Usually our excuses don't sound as good to others as they sound to ourselves. And my fellow deacon, Brother Cliff, has often shared this quote, that excuses only make sense to the one giving them. And so often that's the case. We look lightly at each other's excuses, but we expect ours to mean something. Now, this message does not talk a lot necessarily about excuses, but it does talk about the context out of which excuses often arise. And that context is the principles of responsibility and the accountability that goes along with responsibility. That's what we're actually looking at tonight. And what we do with that is going to determine whether we choose to make excuses or otherwise. Now, I find responsibility a unique thing, and I think you all are very careful to train your children to accept responsibility. You teach them responsibility because you know that in order for them to become mature adults, they need to learn to take responsibility. And some children like, but then when they find out the accountability that goes with it, then they're not so eager after all. That's how that can go. The excuses begin. So let's look at these point at a time here. Point number one for the evening is simply that man was created for responsibility. Man was created for responsibility. In Genesis 1, God made Adam responsible before he made him. Did you know that? Because God made all the other living creatures, and then before he made man, he said this, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion or rule over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So his purpose for making man was to make a being that would be bestowed with responsibilities, I should say, and be accountable to God himself. So that purpose was in place before man was even created. And Adam's responsibilities did not stop with ruling over the animal kingdom and the earth. Here were some more responsibilities. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. That was a responsibility. Subdue the earth. Take control of it. Dress and keep the Garden of Eden. Do not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And name all the animals. And then when after the fall, God sent man out of the garden to till the ground from which he came in order to survive. So these were all responsibilities that God gave to Adam and Eve. So as a result, humanity cannot escape responsibility. Sometimes we'd like to, perhaps, but we can't. Because here's the simple reason for that, and that is the fact that we did not create ourselves. If we were the creator, we could decide that. But we did not create ourselves, and therefore, because we're created beings, we bear responsibility. We are given responsibility. God made man a responsible creature. So how does that affect us so many years later? Are we still responsible creatures? Well, listen to a few verses. Because God has gives us some very clear responsibilities too, and I'm not going to say them all. Philippians 2:12, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. We are responsible for the salvation of our own soul. That's personal responsibility. Ephesians 4:15, grow up into Christ in all things. We are each responsible for our own spiritual health and growth. That's our responsibility. 2 Corinthians 10:5, bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. We are responsible for the thoughts that we harbor in our minds. 2 Thessalonians 3:10. If any would not work, neither should he eat. We are responsible to supply for ourselves materially and physically. And so therefore it takes work and energy to survive. And that's our personal responsibility. And we could go on. But I just want to impress upon us tonight that God created man as a responsible being. We can't escape that. Nobody in the world can escape that. They might try, but they're deceiving themselves. They are responsible. Point number two, with responsibility comes accountability. Another simple fact. And that too was established at creation because when God forbid Adam and Eve to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he made them accountable. He said, in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. They were accountable. And for how they used the responsibilities that God had given them. And so it is for us today. Ezekiel 18:4, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. Romans 14:12, so then every one of us shall give account of himself to God. 2 Corinthians 5:10, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that every one may receive the things done in his body according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. So the second principle of responsibility is that with responsibility comes accountability. And Jesus said it this way in Luke 12:48, listen to this, for unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall be much required, and to whom men have committed much, of him they will ask the more. So accountability always follows responsibility. There is no excuses. That's the fact of life that we can't get away from. Now, as I thought of preparing this message, I thought about a story in the Old Testament, and it's going to take a little time, but I'd like to read it together. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 20. It's a lengthy chapter. But the Bible tells us that these stories are written for examples and for our learning. And this is a story here in the Old Testament that has just a lot of responsibilities given, excuses made, and accountability assigned. And as we read this chapter, I want you to think of that, and I want you to look for those times when there was responsibilities given, there was excuses made, and there was accountability called for. So, story about Ahab, 1 Kings chapter 20. A little bit long, but let's see if we can get through this. Okay, 1 Kings chapter 20. And Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, gathered all his host together, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots. And he went up and besieged Samaria, that was Ahab's city, and warred against it. And he sent messengers to Ahab, king of Israel, into the city, and said unto him, thus saith Ben-Hadad, thy silver and thy gold is mine, thy wives also, and thy children, even the goodliest, are mine. And the king of Israel answered and said, my lord, O king, according to thy saying, I am thine and all that I have. And the messengers came again and said, thus speaketh Ben-Hadad, saying, although I have sent unto thee, saying, thou shalt deliver me of thy silver and thy gold and thy wives and thy children, yet I will send my servants unto thee tomorrow about this time, and they shall search thine house and the houses of thy servants. And it shall be that whatsoever is pleasant in thine eyes, they shall put it in their hand and take it away. Then the king of Israel called all the elders of the land and said, mark, I pray you, and see how this man seeketh mischief. For he sent unto me for my wives and for my children and for my silver and for my gold, and I denied him not. And all the elders and all the people said unto him, hearken not unto him nor consent. Wherefore he sent unto the messengers of Ben-Hadad, tell my lord the king, all that thou didst send for to thy servant at the first I will do, but this thing I may not do. And the messengers departed and brought him word again. And Ben-Hadad sent unto him and said, the gods do so unto me and more also, if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for the handfuls for all the people that follow me. And the king of Israel answered and said, tell him, let not him that girdeth on his harness boast himself as he that putteth it off. And it came to pass, when Ben-Hadad heard this message, as he was drinking, he and the kings in the pavilions, that he said unto his servants, set yourselves in array. And they set themselves in array against the city. Behold, there came a prophet unto Ahab king of Israel, saying, thus saith the Lord, hast thou seen all this great multitude? Behold, I will deliver it into thine hand this day, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord. And Ahab said, by whom? And he said, thus saith the Lord, even by the young men of the princes of the province. Then he said, who shall order the battle? And he answered, thou. Then he numbered the young men of the princes of the provinces, and they were 232. And after them he numbered all the people, even all the children of Israel, being 7,000. And they went out at noon, but Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in the pavilions, he and the kings, the 32 kings that helped him. And the young men of the princes of the provinces went out first, and Ben-Hadad sent out, and they told him, saying, there are men come out of Samaria. And he said, whether they be come out for peace, take them alive, or whether they be come out for war, take them alive. So these young men of the princes and of the provinces came out of the city, and the army which followed them. And they slew every one his man, and the Syrians fled, and Israel pursued them, and Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, escaped on an horse with the horsemen. And the king of Israel went out and smote the horses and the chariots, and slew the Syrians with a great slaughter. And the prophet came to the king of Israel and said unto him, go strengthen thyself, and mark, and see what thou doest, for at the return of the year the king of Syria will come up against thee. And the servants of the king of Syria said unto him, their gods are gods of the hills, therefore they were stronger than we. But let us fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. And do this thing, take the kings away, every man out of his place, and put captains in their rooms. And number thee an army like the army that thou hast lost, horse for horse and chariot for chariot, and we will fight against them in the plain, and surely we shall be stronger than they. And he hearkened unto their voices and did so. And it came to pass at the return of the year that Ben-Hadad numbered the Syrians and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. And the children of Israel were numbered and were all present and went against them. And the children of Israel pitched before them like two little flocks of kids. But the Syrians filled the country. And there came a man of God and spake unto the king of Israel and said, thus saith the Lord, because the Syrians have said, the Lord is God of the hills, but he is not God of the valleys. Therefore will I deliver all this great multitude into thine hand, and ye shall know that I am the Lord. And they pitched one over against the other 7 days. And so it was that in the seventh day, the battle was joined, and the children of Israel slew of the Syrians 100,000 footmen in one day. But the rest fled to Aphek into the city, and there a wall fell upon 27,000 of the men that were left. And Ben-Hadad fled and came into the city, into an inner chamber. And his servants said unto him, behold now, we have heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. Let us, I pray thee, put sackcloth on our loins and ropes upon our heads, and go out to the king of Israel, and peradventure he will save thy life. So they girded sackcloth on their loins and put ropes on their heads, and came to the king of Israel and said, thy servant Ben-Hadad saith, I pray thee, let me live. And he said, is he yet alive? He is my brother. Now the men did diligently observe whether anything would come from him, and did hastily catch it. And they said, thy brother Ben-Hadad. Then he said, go ye, bring him in. Then Ben-Hadad came forth to him, and he caused him to come up into the chariot. And Ben-Hadad said unto him, the cities which my father took from thy father I will restore. And thou shalt make streets for thee in Damascus, as my father made in Samaria. Then said Ahab, I will send thee away with this covenant. So he made a covenant with him and sent him away. And a certain man of the sons of the prophets said unto his neighbor, in the word of the Lord, smite me, I pray thee. And the man refused to smite him. Then said he unto him, because thou hast not obeyed the voice of the Lord, behold, as soon as thou art departed from me, a lion shall slay thee. And as soon as he was departed from him, a lion found him and slew him. Then he found another man and said, smite me, I pray thee. And the man smote him so that in smiting him, he wounded him. So the prophet departed and waited for the king by the way, and disguised himself with ashes upon his face. And as the king passed by, he cried unto the king and said, thy servant went out into the midst of the battle, and behold, a man turned aside and brought a man unto me and said, keep this man, if by any means he be missing, then shall thy life be for his life, or else thou shalt pay a talent of silver. And as thy servant was busy here and there, he was gone. And the king of Israel said unto him, so shall thy judgment be, thyself hast decided it. And he hasted and took the ashes away from his face. And the king of Israel discerned him that he was of the prophets. And he said unto him, thus saith the Lord, because thou hast let go out of thy hand a man whom I appointed to utter destruction, therefore thy life shall go for his life, and thy people for his people. And the king of Israel went to his house, heavy and displeased, and came to Samaria. Now this story, this long story, is actually three stories in one. We have the story of the prophet who refused to do what God told him to do. We have the story made up by the prophet who was sent to call judgment on Ahab. And of course, we have the larger story of Ahab and Ben-Hadad and their wars. And I think all three of these stories have elements that we can use in our subject tonight. First of all, I'd like to draw attention to the man that was asked to wound the prophet. God wanted him to do this. God gave him a responsibility, and he said, "No, I will not do that." And we're not told what his excuses were. There must have been some. Probably he wanted to avoid accountability. Did you hurt this man? Maybe he didn't want to get involved. But he was accountable for not taking up the responsibility he was asked to do. He was accountable, and the other prophet said, "A lion's going to kill you," and that's exactly what happened. He gave his life because he evidently made excuses. Man was created for responsibility, and this man refused his responsibility. Now let's talk a little bit more about this made-up story that could easily have happened. I'm sure things like that happened a lot in times of war. There was a soldier in a battle, and somebody said to him, "Hey, you keep this prisoner here. It's a prisoner of war. You keep this man, and if he gets away, you're either going to pay, comes out to about $32,000, or you're going to get killed yourself." Sounds pretty high stakes, doesn't it? Well, the man got away, and so this man came, the soldier got away, the prisoner got away, and so this man went to Ahab, like, "You know, I need your help, because look what's happening to me. I'm either going to get killed, or I have to pay this huge fine that I can't afford to pay." And Ahab said, "You're guilty. That's what you get. That was the agreement. You're guilty. You decided it yourself. There's no excuses." So now, while this soldier accepted his responsibility, he didn't take it seriously. He realized his accountability too late. And now we have Ahab, and this whole story is really about him. And we know that he wasn't a godly man. He wasn't a godly king. He was a selfish man that cared more about himself than he did about the people that he was ruling over. And these people were actually God's people. They were the Israelites. But Ahab was more important than him in his own eyes than taking care of God's people. Because one of the responsibilities of a king was to protect his people. And when Ben-Hadad came, he basically said, "I'm coming for your money and I'm coming for your family." And Ahab said, "Sure, go ahead. You can have it. I'm not going to get involved. I'm not going to fight." He refused to take up his responsibility as a king. That's why he was a king, and he refused to take that. No effort to fulfill his responsibility. I don't know what all his excuses were. Probably didn't want to fight. Probably scared to fight. Sometimes we accept responsibilities, and then when we find out what all is involved, we start backing away. Well, I think Ben-Hadad wanted to fight. He wanted more than he was saying he wanted. And so he came back again, said, "You know what? We're going to do whatever we want. We're going to take whatever we want." And for the first time, it seems Ahab began to get a little concerned. He went to his counselors and he said, "You know, I don't like the way this is going. Should I be concerned here? Or what should I do with this?" And they said, No. "You can't let this guy do this to you. No. And so Ahab goes back to the messengers and said, "This thing I may not do." Does that sound like taking responsibility? "See, the guy said I can't do this. See, this thing I may not do." Again, he was trying to shift the responsibility to those that he had got counsel from. Still wasn't taking responsibility. Well, Ben-Hadad said, "I'm coming to fight." And so in verse 11, we have that very interesting verse where Ahab, and I don't know, it's so fascinating to me that this man that would not take responsibility, when it came down to it, he told Ben-Hadad, "Well, you don't boast until it's over. You better be careful what you say, because we didn't fight yet." And as I thought about that, you know, sometimes we talk big. Sometimes people tend to brag in the hopes that somehow, if I brag, this will all work out and I'll look good in the end. Is that what Ahab was doing here? It almost seems that way, because I don't know why he was bragging. Up until now, he was a pure chicken. But maybe I'll just get lucky, and then this will all look great. Well, in verse 14, Ahab was told that who's going to run this battle, he asked, and they said, you. You are responsible to run this battle, to run the show, to lead out. And there was two battles. And Israel won both of them. They were probably 6 months or a year apart. We're not told how long it was. But the first battle was won with a great slaughter. And in the second battle, the Israelites killed 100,000 soldiers in one day. And then they were really fortunate because a wall fell on 27,000 more enemies and killed them. And Ben-Hadad was hiding with just a couple servants. And they said, look, we might as well beg for mercy. And they said, we think the kings of Israel are merciful kings. Well, you know, this Mr. Nice Guy Ahab was taken as merciful. He shouldn't have been known as merciful to an enemy. He should have been shouldering his responsibility and taking care of this and not trying to come out as Mr. Nice Guy. Because when Ben-Hadad showed up, he was done fighting. He said, oh, he's my brother. Bring him in. Yeah, hi, brother. How you doing? Kind of sorry this all happened. Let's just lay it all down. And again, refusing to take responsibility. Well, we have the verdict of the prophet that met Ahab on the way home. And he said, thy life shall go for his life, for Ben-Hadad's life, and thy people for his people. And now Ahab went home heavy and displeased. And that means he went home sullen. And when we're sullen, when we're frustrated the way things went, and we know we didn't do what we should have did, and in our mind we're playing excuses that we over and over, well, I couldn't because, and I should have, but I didn't, and on, yes, we end up sullen. That's how Ahab went home. He knew what he had done wrong, but he refused to repent of it, and he went home sullen. Well, now I'd like to shift our focus to another Old Testament man who was, his life was full of faithfully accepting responsibility no matter what. Whatever was his responsibility, he shouldered it. And we certainly can't look at his whole life, but turn to Genesis chapter 39. For just a little glimpse of Joseph in one of the supreme tests that he faced and came through victorious. Now we know the story of Joseph. He was sold as a slave down to Egypt, and he ended up being sold as a slave to this Potiphar, who was a very important man, and he worked there in his house. And as he worked there, he shouldered that responsibility to the point that he was placed over the whole business, we might say, over the whole house. He was over all the servants. He was that good at accepting responsibility and faithfully doing his duties that he just, you know, he was made the head. And then he faced an enormous temptation. Genesis 39, starting reading at verse 4. And Joseph found grace in Potiphar's sight, and he served him, and he made him oversee over his house, and all that he had he put into his hand. And it came to pass from the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. And he had left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught he had, save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well-favored. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused, and said unto his master's wife, behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand. There is none greater in this house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And it came to pass, as she spake to Joseph day by day, that he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. And it came to pass about this time that Joseph entered the house to do his business, and there was none of the men of the house there within. And she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out. And it came to pass, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth, that she called unto the men of her house and spake unto them, saying, "See, he hath brought in an Hebrew unto us to mock us. He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. And it came to pass, when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And she laid up his garment by her until his lord came home. And she spake unto him according to these words, saying, The Hebrew servant which thou hast brought into us came in unto me to mock me. And it came to pass, as I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled out. And it came to pass, when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spake unto him, saying, After this manner did thy servant to me, that his wrath was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were bound, and he was there in the prison. Now, we don't have to wonder about Joseph's level of accepting responsibility. He shouldered whatever came his way. He was only a servant. He was a slave. But he did whatever he was asked. And it said, and as he continued to work there, he continued to do a better and better job. And you know, us men like to do a better job, especially as long as the pay gets better, don't we? I doubt that Joseph's pay got any better. I doubt that he even got paid. He probably got room and board. But that didn't matter, because he accepted his responsibility regardless of the pay, regardless of the position it gained him. He simply was doing what he was asked to do. Well, this wicked woman enticed him. And though she tried day by day, he strongly refused her. And in the end, it cost him his freedom. It cost him his job. It cost him his position. It cost him everything. But I had to wonder about that. What was Joseph's secret to victory in this situation when he was so tempted? He had no godly associates to turn to for strength. He didn't have the Bible like we have it. He had no family to turn to. I don't know how the Old Testament saints related to the idea of a Holy Spirit to lead and guide them. They couldn't have had what we have today. And you know, he had missed out on so much in life already. What's the use? But he was a man of integrity, a man of character. And I want us to look together at verse 9, because I think here is the key to Joseph's victory. Verse 9, I'd like us to read together, starting the last 12 words, starting with the word how. All together, verse 9, starting at the word how. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? There was his perspective that kept him faithful. He had a strong awareness that the responsibility for his purity of character was given to him by God. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And we call that the fear of God. The fear of God. Here's a quote. The fear of God is an indelible impression of the presence of God. An indelible means impossible to eliminate or forget. I want to ask you tonight, do you have that tonight? Do we have an indelible, impossible to forget that God is right here? So often that's why we fail, because we forget. We don't have that indelible impression that God is right here. Let's look at some of the people we've talked about. The man who refused to strike the prophet did not have an indelible impression of the presence of God, or he would have obeyed. The man that was put in charge of keeping the prisoner did not have an indelible impression of the presence of God. Ahab certainly did not have an indelible impression of the presence of God. I'm afraid even Joseph's father, Jacob, didn't always have that, because when he was fleeing from Esau and he saw that vision in the night, he said, "I didn't know God was here." And it seems Jacob's life was full of times when he forgot that God is right here. And so we call him a deceiver. Doesn't say he didn't know the Lord, but maybe he should have been more aware of God's presence. And as we think of these men, that didn't have this impression of God, what did they have? They were guided and directed by their own desires. And you can't really do both. You can't really have an indelible impression of the presence of God and still serve yourself. Now, I guess I have a burden for this because, and I'm going to use this, I don't know how it is up here in Canada, probably a lot like in the United States. We're faced with this thing called the internet. And so as a group, we say, well, we're going to have accountability to each other. And that's a super good thing. That's a good thing. Maybe we should have more accountability in other areas. I'm not sure. But here's the question I had to ask as I thought on this. How could Joseph be victorious in this situation and he wasn't accountable to anybody? There was nobody looking over his shoulder. He had an indelible impression of the presence of God, regardless of the fact that nobody was watching him. Now, here's the question. We're told that in the end times, the world is going to get worse and worse. So we put accountability in place for each other. Now, here's my question that I struggle a little bit with. I'm not saying accountability is wrong at all. I'm not running it down. But can we add enough accountability as time goes on to face a wickeder and wickeder and wickeder society that's pressing itself upon us? I'm not sure if we can. Because if the only thing between my carnality and the sin that I'd like to practice is interpersonal accountability, it's probably not going to work. You may know with me people that have had all kinds of accountability put on them, and they get around it. It's not working. I'm not against it. Please understand me. It's a good thing. But unless we purpose to have an indelible impression of the presence of God in our hearts at all time, we are in a very weak state, and we need to be honest with that. It's what it's going to take. So, having tried to explain the importance of an indelible impression of the presence of God, the fear of God, let's look at a couple points yet about this fear of God. Number one, an indelible impression of the presence of God is the foundation of a successful life. We need to understand that and we need to believe that. Listen to Psalm 111, verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's how important it is. It is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they that do his commandments. His praise endureth forever. To remotely think that we are wise enough to face the challenges of God, of life, without an indelible impression of the presence of God is foolishness. We're going to have that. And notice the next phrase, a good understanding have all they that do his commandments. Friends, tonight, when we have an indelible impression of the presence of God, we will be obedient to his commandments. We will be walking in his ways. Because we will be considering, he's right here with me. So what am I doing on my phone? Where am I going? What am I wearing? What music am I listening to? He is right here with me. And that's what made Joseph successful. And if we have that, it will lead us to obedience. And the last phrase of that verse says, and his praise endureth forever. And that's what he wants out of our lives. Praise enduring forever. And as we do that, as we follow this principle, our lifetime becomes a life of praising God. An indelible impression of the presence of God is the foundation of a successful life. Point number two. An indelible impression of the presence of God creates an openness to his wishes. Turn to Psalm 139. Psalm 139, I'd like to read verses 5 to 12. Psalm 139, Thou hast set me behind and before, and laid thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit, or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light around me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day, and the darkness and the light are both alike unto thee. How did the psalmist get to this place where he realized that God was always present? Well, look at the end of the chapter, verses 23 and 24. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. When we realize, when we have this indelible impression of the presence of God, we desire an openness with him. We want him to look at our lives and our hearts. We want his word to shine in every part of our heart and see what's there. We want to be open, and we have a burning desire to do his will. Point number three, an indelible impression of the presence of God is possible only through effort. If you thought this is an easy thing or it's so haphazard you can have it, you're wrong. Turn to Proverbs 2. This doesn't happen automatically. Proverbs 2, verses 1 to 5. Listen for what these verses say is needful to experience an indelible impression of the presence of God. Proverbs 2, 1 to 5. My son, if thou wilt receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thine ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart to understanding, yea, if thou criest after knowledge and liftest up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasures, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. Are you willing to put that into it? To have this fear of the Lord, you have to be willing to be spent in order to have it. It's very clear. This doesn't happen automatically. It takes sacrifice. It takes effort. But isn't it worth it? To have a victorious life, a life of blessing, this is how you get it. Point number four, an indelible impression of the presence of God provides hope for the future. I believe that Joseph's awareness of the presence of God did a lot more for him than just keeping him from moral failure. I believe it sustained him in his bad times, his times when he could have been so discouraged. It sustained him. I believe it was the secret behind his success as the leader there in Egypt. No experience, but God blessed him. Why? Because he had that connection. And I believe it's the reason that he could live his life without excuses. But it also gave him a focus and a vision beyond the present. Because in Genesis 50, verses 24 and 25, we have his last request. Listen to what it is. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land into the land which he sware to Abram, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath to the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from hence. Joseph had a vision. Why? Because he had an indelible impression of the presence of God. He knew that this Egypt was not where he belonged, and he wanted to go home where the people of God were going to be. And Moses, as we are told, took Joseph's bones along back to Canaan. So his indelible impression of the presence of God gave him a faith in the future of God's people. So my question to us tonight is, which will I choose? Which will you choose? Will you choose a life of excuses? Will you choose a life of an indelible impression of the presence of God to such an extent that you simply can't forget about it? You can't find release from it. He's always there, and you welcome that. You want that. And when you're through, he will say, come on in. You're my child. It's the choice that we're all going to make as we go down through life. So let's be faithful. I don't think we're going to give an invitation tonight, but if you sense a need in your life, please make it known. And pray for the service services tomorrow. Right now it looks like a pretty big job, but we'll try to continue on. So let's stand for dismissal.